Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Ari Shavit, senior correspondent with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz and author of My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. The topic of today's talk will be My Promised Land, A Personal Journey Through the History of Israel. This is part two of a two-part lecture given by Mr. Shavit. It was presented as the 2015 Ruthenfeld Sokoloff Lecture. This program, co-sponsored by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 23, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Moshe Gershovich, the director of the Schwab Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Every year there are probably at least dozens, but more likely hundreds of books published about Israel. And it's only every once in a while that you get a real amazing book about Israel. And the book that is the basis for the lecture of this evening is one of them. I'm sure that many of you already had a chance to read it or at least hear about it. I first came across it when I was preparing for a study abroad, the trip to Israel with a class of mine. I was looking for books to get the students to read and came across Ari Shavit's book, and I knew immediately that this is the book to use for the class, and I'll be using it again. It's really a very well-written book by somebody with a unique perspective about Israel. He's an Israeli born, and by the way, it's the first time in the six lectures that we have thus far in this lecture series named after Ruthenfeld Sokoloff, the first time that we have a native-born Israeli who is coming to talk to us. And Ari Shavit served in the Israeli army as a paratrooper. He studied philosophy. And then he found his vocation in journalism and also in working for human rights issues. For many Israelis, myself included, he's best known for his many columns and op-eds in Haaretz, Israel's leading daily, in which he has worked many years and still walking. And I think that there aren't many Israelis who don't know who he is. Many Israelis know who he is, and I can say for myself that usually the first thing I do in the morning is to go to the website of Haaretz, and when I go to the website, the first thing I look for is really whether or not there is a new op-ed by Ari Shavit, because this is the best source for me and for many others to know what's been happening in Israeli politics and to get better acquainted. The book, however, is much more than that. It's really a personal narrative combined with very perceptive and very serious analysis of the great achievements, the great miracle of Israel, as well as the many problems that Israel is faced with. And it is dealing with it in a very frank and sincere way. And those of us who already heard yesterday's portion of what Ari has to share with us, it's really about the future of Israel and how Israel and the Jews in this country and elsewhere, how this partnership should continue. And I think that it's an enormously important work, and the thing that I'm most happy perhaps about is that it's the event that really culminates the celebration that we've been having over the last 24 hours for Israel's 67th birthday. And I can't think of any better way to conclude this celebration than by thinking seriously about the future. So please join me in welcoming Ari Shavit.
Thank you so much, Moshe, for your good words, and thank you all for being here. I already said yesterday that within a few hours I fell in love with your city and with the Jewish community here. I've learned even more since yesterday, so I even have a stronger feeling of affinity and appreciation. I'll say two things. One is that really for me, the fact that in this place that is not New York and not Los Angeles, you have such a lively, solid, deep-rooted community that inspires me. And I'm really moved just by being here and by seeing the temple, seeing the JCC, seeing the Jewish life here. But the second thing that I've learned since is this special thing that you have here, that so many of you have been here for generations. In Israel, people sometimes laugh at me that I'm kind of Mayflower Israeli because my family's been for a long time. I'll be talking soon about my family that came from England over 100 years ago, but my father's family came over 200 years ago, so I'm kind of on the other side. I'm eighth generation Israeli. So, but to see, I don't think there are many places in America where you have this element, and it's so wonderful for me to see how people stick to a place. And if yesterday I had the first impression that there is something very healthy here, now I begin to see some of the explanation of that. So I'm really impressed by you people here, and I'm really honored to be here standing, talking to you. Obviously, this evening's talk is somewhat challenging after yesterday's talk, and after I've been talking about Israel and Middle East issues intensively here for 36 hours, the sound of my own voice is somewhat troubling by now. But what I will try to do, if yesterday was no Hanukkah, but I talked about miracles, today is no Purim, but in May, I'll try to talk about a kind of the Israeli Megillah, the story of Israel. I will not talk about the challenges that I talked yesterday. I'll be talking about some other challenges. But I'll be doing it in a different way, using the story of my book, the way I wrote the book, the reason I wrote the book. So this talk will be about my promised land, the book, and my promised land. But it will converge and meet at the end some of the issues that we discussed yesterday that I've been discussing throughout the day. When I set out on this long journey of writing this book, and believe me, writing a book like this, it's a very lonely journey. You never know if you're doing the right thing or you're totally crazy. But when I set out on this journey, most of my friends told me I should not do it. They said, as Moshe said, that there are so many Israel books out there, and so many of them are great books. And they said there is such deep Israel fatigue. No one will read another Israel book. But I was determined to write a book because of two reasons. Both personal, but the first one, totally personal. Ever since I remember myself, literally from the age of 5 or 6, I remember the notion that I was born in a unique land, in a unique nation, into a unique historical happening. And throughout the years, I had the need to figure it out for myself. Where do I live? What is Israel all about? I'm a journalist. As you can imagine, I have pretty good access. I talk to the prime minister, I talk to the generals, I talk to the ministers. People love me and hate me. It's Israel. It's all intensive. But I had a feeling that even I don't get it. We are so lost in the details, in the ongoing drama, friction, the daily events, the debates, the hate, the fuss, that we lost sight of the bigger picture. There are so many trees there. We don't see the forest anymore. So I had a need personally for myself, even if no one, and I said it to my wife when I got on this, into this, even if no one will read this book, I want to read this book. I had a need to figure it out to myself. But then there was another reason to write the book. Because when I looked into it, I realized that one of Israel's deepest problems, is that we Israelis lost our narrative. Now, any nation needs a narrative. Definitely immigrant nations like you and like us need a narrative. But definitely Israel needs a narrative because we are so vulnerable. And we are Jews. We basically come from the book. But also as Zionists, before Israel was there, we had a narrative, we had a sense of meaning before there was anything else. When there was no state, no army, no economy, no high tech, nothing. We had a narrative. We knew who we are, where we are coming from, and where we want to go. And that enabled everything to happen. This is why we had the internal strength and resilience to deal with all that we had to deal with. But sadly, in recent decades, as Israel grew stronger and richer, the narrative that was so essential, that is so essential, evaporated. This basically happened, in my mind, because of two historical events. One was the 1967 war. The seventh day of the Six-Day War. The debate over the territories, whether they are occupied or liberated, peace or settled. A debate we must have, a debate I participate in, an important debate. But that debate created a crack in our identity, in our internal unity. Up to 67, we were held together by the ethos of the just and the besieged. We had many controversies, but there was no controversy about that. Since 67, there is a deep divide within us, and it's getting worse every year. Every year is worse than the previous one. So that was the one element that threatened, cracked our narrative. But then in my mind, there is another element that is less talked about. Because following the 73 war that came 6 years late, we went through a trauma, and I'll be talking about it a bit. But the result was that post-73 Israel was totally different than what we had before. If before the war we were too arrogant, too self-confident, we had too much trust of our leadership, we were too much into the state and how wonderful we are. After the war, we became too cynical, too critical, too judgmental. It's difficult for us to say good things about us. We lost the ability to appreciate what we have. You'll hear later on, I deeply love my fellow Israelis. I love Israel. I love our life. I think we have a great life. But the public debate in Israel, the public arena, is almost poison. There is acid in the air. And because of this deep phenomenon, we stopped seeing what we are. Many people think, me included, that we have a serious problem for extremism in Israel, and that's true. But we also have a deep problem of cynicism. And cynicism is as dangerous as extremism. So both phenomena, the divide and the cynicism, in many ways destroyed this narrative that was so essential. Now, I didn't have any national ambitions. I didn't come to save the nation. Although I try my best to help whatever way I can. But my mission was to try to bring the narrative back, but to try to bring it in a different way. Because as I said the other day, many people, too many people, treat us Israelis as if we are either demons or angels. We are no angels. We did wrong things, we do wrong things, and we will probably do wrong things. We are definitely not demons. The attempt, the tendency to demonize Israel is ugly, morally and emotionally ugly. We are humans. But we are rather remarkable humans with an extraordinary human story. So what I try to do in the book is to bring back that human element, to bring back the human story. So what I did is to listen to people. You know, I am a very opinionated person. I know the solution to every Israeli problem. But the book was not about my ideas and my political agenda. The book was about listening to my fellow Israelis and trying to bring that back sense of narrative through the personal life stories of specific people that I thought tell in many ways the greater story. And in a sense, what I tried to do is really to transcend the conflicts and debates and all that, and to bring the human phenomena, the emotions with the insights combined. This book is the book of a villager climbing up the hill, looking at his own village, asking himself, what is the village all about? How it was founded? Where is it located? And what does the future hold for it? Obviously, I had to begin with my own beginning. And my own beginning, and that's something that I talked about yesterday, so I will not repeat the entire story. My own beginning is in London of 1897, when my great-grandfather, Herbert Bentwich, decides to travel to Palestine. My great-grandfather was a successful British Jew. Apart from the fact that he was Jewish, he was a Victorian gentleman in every respect. He loved the Queen, he loved the Empire, he loved Shakespeare, and he loved the theater. So the question I ask myself is, why would such a Victorian gentleman, he had at the time 9 children, a beautiful wife, a house that to this day is an amazing mansion in North London, home for the Israeli ambassador. Why leave all that and travel to the remote, desolate province Palestine was? Yesterday I gave the 2 deep answers, the 2 brilliant insights the early Zionists had. But today I want to refer to the great claim against people like him, and against us, the claim that we were colonialists. In my mind, nothing is further than the truth. Because we were not, and we are not, the masters of the universe. We were not sent by some empire. I've been to Australia recently, and I love Australia. In Australia, 5 ships came from Britain and took a land that they had no connection with. And no one says Australia is not legitimate. We went back to our ancient homeland in order to save our lives. I love Australia, but Israel is far more legitimate than Australia. Colonialism We had to run for our lives from Europe. And what we did, we loved Europe so much. People like my grandfather and so many European Jews in Berlin and Paris and Warsaw. They were in love with modern, enlightened Europe. They took their Europe as their mother. Many of them tried to forget their Jewish roots, like Herzl himself. But that adopted mother was becoming a Medea. It suddenly had this crazy look in her eye. It was going to kill us. So what we did in an ingenious way is to use European power, political power, financial power, scientific, technological, in order to build at the very last moment a European-like safe haven away from Europe that will save us from the rage of Europe. That's as far from colonialism as possible. But because I was determined to write the truth as I see it, not to do whitewashing and not to do propaganda, I had to deal with the problem. And the problem is that when my great-grandfather arrived in the port of Jaffa, there was something he would not see. He would not see that the city of Jaffa was predominantly an Arab city with a great Hebrew-Jewish past, but an Arab city. And when he traveled from Jaffa to Jerusalem, he did not see the dozens of Palestinian villages along the road, the railroad. I stand with my great-grandfather. I defend him. As I said, we were no conquistadors. We came back to our ancient homeland. We had the deep need to go there. But we have to acknowledge the fact that we did not see the other. Again, that too has to be put in perspective. There was no Palestinian kingdom we conquered. There was no Palestinian republic. There was not even a Palestinian people. That emerged later on, partly because of the clash with us. But there were 500,000 people in the land, and my great-grandfather did not see them. Why? Several reasons. But the main one is that the desperate need to build a home at the very last moment for our people before we die was so deep that we would not see any obstacle standing in our way. But the result of that is on the one hand, you have this great triumph. The subtitle of my book is The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. On the one hand, the amazing triumph of the human spirit that Israel is. But on the other hand, you have the ongoing tragedy. Because the conflict did not start in 67, and it did not start in these 10, 20 years when we talked to us about it in such a critical way. It started in many ways the moment my great-grandfather and his friends set foot in Palestine. Because we did not see them, and they did not see us. And the mutual blindness set the conflict in motion. So my book, in many ways, is a yin-yang book. Tragedy and triumph. Hope and despair. Greatness, salvation, pain, and agony. This is the drama. This is the amazing drama of Israel. I will not talk about all that I went through in this journey, but I'll mention a few points. The first chapters that I deal with, the places that I traveled to, I will combine two now. And I think they explain the success, the initial amazing success of this project. One is I write about Enchalot, about the kibbutzim, about the first pioneers going into the valley of Chalot. These people were truly giants. One cannot begin to grasp what they did. Now again, you had your heroic pioneers here. But there's something amazing about this small group of people I described, 73 at the beginning. They come from nowhere. They are the ultimate orphans. They lost God. They turned their back on their parents, on their religion, on tradition. They rebel against everything. They rebel against anti-Semitic Europe. They rebel against old Judaism. They rebel against the life of disgrace and poverty they grew up in. They rebel against what they saw as aggressive capitalism. And then they have to fight the land that is so barren. Their task is a superhuman task. It's incredible when you look at their pictures. They come into a place that is so harsh, but they have a sense of mission. They are not religious, but they are more religious than religious people. Because they know they must save our people before the Holocaust happens. Again, they don't know there will be a Holocaust, but they know by this time, they know for sure. Their leader is very aware, by the way, their leader, Tabenkin, understands there is going to be a Holocaust. But they know they are competing against time. Because there are pogroms after World War I. Europe has become more and more hostile. The Jewish communities are perishing. And they feel that they are the only ones who will save this people. And there are so few of them. And the challenge is so incredible. The marshes, the malaria, they die there in the swamps. And the difficulty, they come with this, they build this camp of white tents on the slopes of the Mount of Gilboa. And on the one hand, they work so hard throughout the day, they insist on dancing throughout the night. But the difficulty, the human tension, is incredible. And it's not ideal. There are love affairs that go bad. People commit suicide. There is even a romantic murder in the first year. It's tough and difficult. But when you see how this emerges from nothing, literally nothing, 100 white tents, small tents, and within months, something begins to appear. The first tractor, the first piano, beginning of a library, the fields, and they dry up the swamps. But throughout the time, as one of them says, they feel naked. They're totally exposed. They have the yearning to old Europe, to the forests, to the softness. And they live with these rocks and barren land. But they do not surrender. And they built this Emek Israel that is actually the first region that becomes a real Zionist region because they have the first kibbutz and then the others. But then I describe 10 years later, in the 30s, my hometown of Rehovot, many years before I was born. And Rehovot is so different because it's the other element of the Zionist revolution. There is no communist kind of socialism there. It's a free market entity. It's a colony that is all about the orange groves. Now, the orange groves, the Jaffa orange groves, are so magical. Because in many ways, these orange groves are our first high-tech enterprise. It's so sophisticated. The Jews come to Palestine with no agricultural experience. And within 2-3 decades, the orange growers of California are writing to Washington that there is danger because of the Palestine, the Jewish orange groves in Palestine. This miniature Jewish Palestine is producing in the most sophisticated way these amazing oranges that take 1/3 of the British market. But it's not only that it's an incredible, they bring prosperity to the country in an amazing way. But it's not only that success. But there is harmony there because Arabs and Jews work together. And there is a kind of balance. And that Rehovot of the middle 30s is such not only a success, but it's really like an idyllic home for these homeless people that are beginning to do something. So while you have the zeal and the revolutionary spirit on the one hand, you have this search for normalcy of a people who live an unnormal life, who are trying to bring remedy after such a long, tormented history. So if you let me to go back in time, there is nowhere I'd like to go back to rather than the Eretz Israel of 1935, when it's so promising, when Zionism is as just, as wonderful, and successful as possible. Even Tel Aviv, that is like a mini megalopolis, only 100,000 people, but with the spirit of a megalopolis, is so full of culture and life and literature. The youngsters of Tel Aviv today think they invented the Tel Aviv party. The Tel Aviv party was invented many years before. So this combination of the superhuman project with this sense of normalcy and this love of life, this is what makes that young Israel, before Israel was established, so endearing. But then, reality strikes. And the most important year in our history is 1936. Everything that happened before led to it, and everything that happened since is footnotes to what happened in 1936. Because that terrible conflict, clash with our neighboring Arabs that we ignored, that we did not want to see, suddenly erupts. And there is violence. Jews are lynched in Jaffa. And it just goes as the end of the Orange Grove season. In the Orange Grove port, in that city that my great-grandfather came to, this brutal Middle East violence erupts. And suddenly, we ran away from the pogroms, and we have a pogrom in this promised land that we came to. But the Jewish Zionist reaction to that is so interesting, because the first reaction is really remarkable. We don't go into violence. We don't go into fighting. The way we stand against this is by building a port for Tel Aviv, by building while saying we shall not surrender. And there's something so impressive about that reaction. But sadly, months later, a year later, we become brutal too. And we have to acknowledge it. They began the violence. They began the attack. But we are being brutalized by the process. And this conflict to this day, the rocket that landed tonight in southern Israel was fired by people who see Ezzedine Al-Qassam as their hero. Ezzedine Al-Qassam was the Palestinian leader of 1935. It's the same story. This is what makes it such a tragedy. And the tragedy comes to a climax in 1948. And I have this sensitive chapter that I wrote about what happened in the city of Lida. And it's so important to understand that it happened. At the end of the day, we saved ourselves while bringing tragedy upon our neighbors. But again, I reject any attempt to use this in order to delegitimize Israel. Because we have to remember, I write about the city of Lida, that its population was expelled by the Israeli forces. But we have to remember that that happened in a context of a war where there was no mercy. No mercy. It was a vicious civil war. And wherever the Arabs won in that war, wherever they conquered, not one Jew remained. So the reason I have a chapter about Lida is that we won the war. Otherwise, we would have not been in the land. And we would have probably been slaughtered. But it's also, we have to remember that the 1940s were not 2015. Britain, not talking about Nazis, but Britain did Dresden. That was 100 times worse than Lida. And no one says that Britain is not legitimate because of Dresden. America, with due respect, did Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that was 1,000 times more worse than Lida. And there was no existential threat for the United States at that part, that stage of the war. No one says the United States is not legitimate because Hiroshima of Nagasaki. So on the one hand, we have to acknowledge the dark part of our history, the fact that we did things that are so harsh and in many ways horrible. But on the other hand, we have to understand the context, that there was no other way, and we did it just when we were really threatened in the literally the most existential way possible. Later on, I talked yesterday about the greatness of Israel of the 50s. But Israel was also when we absorbed such large number of immigrants against all odds. But it wasn't only the 50s. This kind of Israeli miracle kept itself into the 60s and early 70s. Just as an example, I have a chapter about the building of Dimona, our nuclear reactor, which is such a tragic project again, because we had the need to acquire this unique ability to defend ourselves. But we did it in such an astounding way and in a moral way. Because when we realized we have to do it, we did it. Unbelievable that we did it. But we decided we will live as if we don't have it. We kept it as a rainy day option. We were so responsible with this. Although we were threatened and we had wars, we never made cheap political use of this unique ability. We just kept it because of our terrible history and because of what we are faced with. And at the same time that Dimona is being built, the Israel Museum is being built in Jerusalem. Israel is still so young, so fragile, so poor. But we bring Rembrandt to Jerusalem, a mile from the border. We really create a kind of modern, liberal democracy against all odds in the most difficult circumstances. And in many ways, Israel is a kind of mini America, but it faces such amazing challenges that, thank God, America does not challenge. And that was the beauty of it. But the sad thing is that after the 67 war that I mentioned and the 73 war and the political change in Israel in 1977, we lost our way politically. We do not have the kind of leadership we had before. We don't have the kind of ethos that hold us together. We lost that narrative. And the kind of inner moral discipline that we had for 60, 70 years that made Israel so incredible. First, it all created it and then made it so incredible. That was sadly lost in the last 30, 40 years. So when you look at Israel of recent years, what you actually see, and if you try to understand that mess, what's going on there? It's so confusing, so colorful and confusing. It's actually the disintegration of the first Israeli republic that was created by Ben-Gurion and kept us together and kept us rational, tough sometimes, but seeking the best, and the disintegration of that republic into a kind of political vacuum in which many Israelis are doing amazing things on a personal level. And Israeli society is so rich and wonderful. But there is no leadership and there is no political body that holds the entire entity together. And many people rebel against the old order without substituting it with a kind of new order that deals with the overall Israeli condition. I ended my book with a chapter, a journey going in the footsteps of my great-grandfather, looking at my country, asking myself, what have we achieved and what have we not? Where have we succeeded and where have we failed? And what I see is basically two phenomena. On the one hand, Israel is the most intimidated democracy on the face of the planet. I oppose occupation and settlement. But I urge everybody to remember that there is not only occupation but intimidation. That we are threatened like no others. This terrible tragedy of the conflict is manifested today by a tension between many, many of our neighbors and us. Even when it seems calm, you don't know what tomorrow holds. There is sadly the religious tension between many of our Muslim neighbors and us. This is why we are waiting for this great message that will come from Omaha to bring some harmony to the relationship between the religions in our region. Then there is the tension, the national tension, between the Jewish democratic state and an Arab, predominantly Arab region that is not kind to its minorities and does not accept as legitimate non-Arab entities, not only Israel. Look how the Kurds were treated. Look how the Copts are treated in Egypt. Look how any other minority is treated in the Middle East. The Middle East is not kind to its minority, and we are the ultimate minority. Sometimes people forget that. And then there is the tension of this terrible conflict with the Palestinians, which is an existential, deep conflict that has social elements, cultural elements, historical elements, identity elements. So because of these three sources of tension, the Israeli condition is unique. It's different. We want to believe that we are California, but we are not. We resemble California in many ways. We have the high tech. We have the beach boys and the beach girls. We have the same skies, blue skies, the orange grove history. But we are a California by the volcano. We are a California surrounded by Ayatollahs and ISISs and Al-Qaedas. And we somehow have to maintain this tension of how do we keep our California-like values and our California-like way of life within that terrible environment. So this is, on the one hand, this is the manifestation of the tragedy. But on the other hand, the triumph to this day is what we do in this situation. Because we live on the edge, but we turned our life on the edge into such a source of energy. We decided not to be defeated again. Not by our history, but this ongoing tragedy. So we do not, in this sense, we do not go into kind of pessimism and passivity. And there's something so impressive about the Israeli spirit. Zionism failed in bringing about the utopia it wanted to create. That kibbutz dream is shattered. There will be no socialist paradise there. But Zionism succeeded in creating one of the most impressive, robust free societies one can imagine. We Israelis are so innovative and creative and sensual and sexy. We make more babies than any other OECD country. And when you come to Israel, you are overwhelmed by this burst of energy everywhere. Everybody heard about the high-tech boom, but that's only one of the manifestations, as remarkable as it is. You feel this intensity of life in theater, in art, in poetry, in commerce, in technology, in science, and the relationships people have with one another. I'm telling you, between wars, we have the best life possible. And when you look at when they check all these international polls, Israelis are so much happier than Swedes. The Swedish tend to be melancholic and depressive with all their social paradise. We face with all this balagan, and we are full of life. We are full of beings. Israel is so alive and kicking. Am Israel is truly chai. So this is the yin-yang. On the one hand, a condition and challenges that if my great-grandfather would have known that his grand grandchildren have to go to the army, have to wear gas masks, have to be worried about a nuclear war, have to be faced with all they have to face, he probably would have run away. But on the other hand, we live with all that in such a colorful, lively way. So what is Israel? Yesterday I gave one answer. I said that Israel is a phenomenon of vitality against all odds. But what I will say today is that what's so remarkable about Israel is that we are a people that have come from death and are threatened by death, but have chosen life. And with all its faults, with all its problems, with all its sins, Israel is such an amazing celebration of life and such an oasis of liberty. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm all yours.
The question I have is actually regarding your statements on the Arab-Israelis, this occupation, the settlements that you're saying is a terrible situation for the state of Israel. I know that I've been to Israel a few times. I went inside to Bethlehem. I spoke with local Palestinians inside of their territories, and they would love nothing more than to slaughter you without a question in my mind. I know we see this on the news all the time. Every moment they have an opportunity to capture an Israeli or children and kill them, they never cease on that opportunity. And when it came to, obviously, bringing the people to justice that killed those three kids. So my question to you is, it sounds like you're to blame the cause on the occupation and the settlements without really focusing on what really is at hand. My question is two questions really. One, in the Bible, you know, I don't know if you know in the Bible it states when you come into the land of Israel, if you don't wipe out the inhabitants, they will become a thorn in your side. This is in the Torah, right? So my question is, why do you focus on the occupation and the settlements as the founding problem, which is the cause of the Jewish people and the anti-Semitism and all this hatred, without recognizing the underlying problem that is these people are the underlying problem? It's not the state of Israel that's in the so-called occupation territories. It is this counterpart party that seems to go on continuously, which would be the issue.
Okay. So apparently I failed in my mission. I wasted like 2 hours here because I think for 2 hours I was just explaining why it's not only occupation and settlement. I said it began in 1897, from the moment we arrived there. So I have my interpretation, you have yours. But the one thing one cannot challenge me with is the claim that I think that the conflict is because of occupation and settlement. And this is where I differ with some other peaceniks, because I really think that that approach is wrong. That does not mean that occupation and settlements are neither nor justified. You know, I studied philosophy. There is a kind of logical flaw in the right-wing argument that jumps from one to the other. The fact that the conflict is not about occupation and settlement does not mean that we need occupation and settlement. Because my argument is that occupation and settlement are endangering us. Aren't they? You don't have to agree, but this is the argument. I'm definitely, no, I said it. The conflict did not begin in 67. The conflict did not begin when Benjamin Netanyahu walked into his office, and it won't end the moment he's out of his office, if it ever happens. So my entire belief is that there is this, you know, I wrote a book about it. I spent 7 years in getting into the depth of it. So the one argument you cannot have with me is about like the shallow argument about the occupation cell. And yet, I think that we must deal with this both because it's not fair to the Palestinians, because they need a place under the sun. We need a place under the sun, they need a place under the sun. As long as their place under the sun does not drive us to the sea. So I'm very cautious about it. We should not make any concessions that are suicidal. But we have to make those concessions that will make us stronger and guarantee our future. But the present situation, we disagree, but that's legitimate, the present situation endangers us in the most dramatic way. I'm an Iran alarmist, as people heard yesterday, but this is dangerous. Because if we endanger our soul, our identity, if we endanger our relationship with the West, if we lose our legitimacy and our integrity, that's as dangerous as any Arab organization, a fanatic organization. We deal with all the problems, we deal with the rockets, we deal with the security threats. But that challenge to our identity, to who we are, to the Jewish democratic states, we put so much effort. All these pioneers and orange growers and warriors, so much blood, sweat, and tears to create this beloved Israel, to create this wonderful, wonderful Jewish democratic state. And we ourselves are endangering that. So for our own sake, for our own life, so we will have an Amisrael heart, we need to act. We need to do it with caution, with creativity. We should not repeat the mistakes of the past. The old peace concept is not relevant anymore. We need a new peace concept, and I have one. We have to do it in a new way, but we must act. Because right now, this endangers us in the most dramatic way. But because I do not want to end on just the debate, I want to tell you a short story that will tell you why I'm so optimistic about Israel. I have a friend. His name is Yanki. His mother was a baby in the Holocaust. They were all gone. At the end of the war, she was the only person that remained in her family. She was a baby, an orphan. She was 4 or 5 years old at the end of the war. No one wanted to take her. She was put in some kind of orphanage that they had at the time. People would come. She was wild because of all the traumas she went to. People would take her, adopt her, and drop her. But then some couple took her, and she came to Israel. So my friend Yanki grew up with no grandparents, no uncles, no aunts, nothing. His mother was the only survivor. He was and still is a wild Israeli, very bad student, undisciplined soldier. But he had this thing about electronics. He had some talent in it. So in some odd Israeli way, he went on the knock on doors in the Tel Aviv University. People saw he has some talent. And he learned in his own way how to do electronics. And he created one of Israel's first successful startup companies called, let's forget the name, but it was one of the first amazing successes. He was 23, 24 year old with very little formal education, but in this wild anarchistic Israeli way, he had the energy and the talent. So he built a family. His mother has now many grandchildren. What was one person is today dozens, full of life. And now that he ended his startup company, what Yanki is trying to do is to lead a small team of Israelis who are trying to put the first Israeli vehicle on the moon. They are competing in some sort of Google competition in order to put this tiny, funny, strange thing that will be an Israeli technological entity on the moon. So in my mind, this is the story. We come from where we came. We are wild, anarchistic, undisciplined, loud, difficult, neurotic. But there was so little hope there. And against all odds, we created this amazing, bubbling, simmering, energetic entity. And we have this amazing, amazing celebration of life there. And Yanky is not only an entrepreneur, he's also a DJ. That's part of this Israeli wildness. And at the end of the day, after all we went through, and with all that we face, we shoot for the moon. So I have hope.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ari. Thank you all for coming, and see you in our future events.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Ari Shavit, senior correspondent with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, and author of My Promised Land, The Triumph and Tragedy of Israel. His topic today was My Promised Land, A Personal Journey Through the History of Israel. This has been part two of a two-part lecture given by Mr. Shavit. It was presented as the 2015 Ruth and Phil Sokoloff Lecture. This program, co-sponsored by the University of Nebraska at Omaha Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, April 23, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, UNO Media Relations Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 500 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.